The Hoop Heads podcast is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I was able to start varsity as the point guard, and we went down to states, and I hit some big free throws that we won states. I was a key part of the team, and from that point on, I knew that I had a chance. I still wasn't highly recruited my sophomore year, and then my junior year, I started getting some mid majors, but no really big teams, ACC and Big East or things like that. And the letters were coming in, and after we won that state championship, St. Bonaventure from the Atlantic 10, they offered me a scholarship early. I went there for a visit. I liked the visit, and they offered a scholarship, and I accepted it. And after that, I had an incredible senior year. I averaged 25, 26 points a game, and that's when a lot of the bigger schools came talking and came recruiting. But I'm a loyal person, and I didn't even consider going to any of those teams. So I ended up at St. Bonaventure.
J.R. Bremmer was born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio. Growing up, he was never one of the big names, and in fact, he wasn't even going to make his high school varsity team at Cleveland Heights High School, according to his middle school coach. J.R. wasn't considered a top player in the state or the country, and was pretty much under the radar his whole career. He won a state championship his junior year at Cleveland Heights and earned a scholarship to St. Bonaventure University for college. The Bonnies made the NCAA tournament his sophomore year and lost to Kentucky in double overtime in a game hosted at Cleveland State University. J.R. played 2 years in the NBA with three teams, the Boston Celtics, the Cleveland Cavaliers, and the Golden State Warriors. He was all-rookie second team in the NBA with the Celtics, and after his time in the NBA, J.R. went on to play 13 years professionally in Europe. J.R. Bremmer's story is one that every player, coach, and parent should hear. You don't have to be a big name or get tons of exposure. You just need to keep working at your game, and eventually opportunities will come your way. Please take some notes and enjoy this conversation with former NBA player, J.R. Bremmer.
Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host, Jason Sunkel. Tonight, we are here with J.R. Bremmer, former Cleveland Heights, St. Bonaventure, NBA, and European professional player. J.R., welcome to the podcast.
Hello, how you guys doing?
We are great. Good. Thanks for staying up late with us tonight. We're doing a rare 11:30 p.m. podcast recording, so we appreciate you being willing to stay up late with us.
Oh, yeah, I appreciate you guys having me anytime.
So talk a little bit about when you first got into the game of basketball and what your experience was like as a youth player.
I got into the game of basketball at a young age. My father and brother put a lot of different sports. They gave me a lot of different sports to try out, and basketball and football and things like that. And basketball was the one that stuck. So I've been going at it since probably about the second or third grade, and it's been a long process, but it was a fun one.
What do you remember most about your early time with the game of basketball? So when you're back in second, third, fourth grade in elementary school, what are some things that you remember? Or what are some of the things that you liked about the game that made you say, hey, this is something that I want to put some time in?
I was small, and I loved to shoot the three. And I just remembered trying to shoot deep threes from whenever, and I touched it, and it just was, I just loved that part of the game, being able to shoot. So that's what really got me into basketball.
Yeah, I think a lot of kids, when you're growing up, I think shooting the ball is what everybody wants to do. I always crack up. I know when I was coaching, one of the things that I would always say to players is, you'd be doing a shooting drill and the kid would be going at like 70% speed. And he'd be like, look, if you don't want to work hard and when you're working on a shooting drill, what's the point? If you're not going to work hard to shoot, that's what everybody loves to do.
And it's funny because I actually had tryouts tonight. I coach in Olmsted Falls and we had tryouts tonight. And the kids are like, these are kids that are choosing to try out for a team and they're not even working hard at all. Like, I'm like, guys, you chose to be here. No one's forced you to come try out for basketball. So, like, we talked about how really hard work shows us that if you're not going to work hard at practice and tryouts, then how do I know you're going to work hard when you play for my team? It cracks me up.
Yeah, I see the kids these days too, and it's the same thing that I witnessed. I learned at a young age that, if I wasn't going to work hard, then we weren't going to be doing any basketball exercise or basketball drills. So they instilled that hard. My family instilled that hard work in me very, very early.
So who was the first influence that you remember in terms of basketball? Was it your dad and then one of your coaches early on, or who was it that really kind of pushed you and helped you to develop your skills as a young player?
It was my dad as a young player. He played at East Tech, and we used to always go work out outside and on the courts and play one-on-one, and he made basketball fun. That's what made me love it. And as I progressed through my years and got better and better, then it moved to my brother who really pushed me really hard.
And how do you think, when you describe it as being fun, what about what your dad did with you? What did he do to make it fun for you?
Just the way he taught me the game, the way he instilled the hard work for me to practice, but it didn't make it unbearable like some people do, and you see certain guys making it tough for these kids, and you say you want them to work hard, but it's not fun for them, and they don't enjoy it. And I think that's a bad way to go about it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really important for coaches out there to remember is what you're saying there, JR, is that, you know, the game. Yeah, you got to, if you want to get to a high level and be able to excel, you do have to work hard. But at the same time, I think it's important for us to remember that it's a game. And if you don't remember that it's a game and it's not fun, then why would a kid want to play if it's not going to be fun? So I think that your dad was definitely on the right track when it came to, you know, trying to help you develop and get better at it. So when you get done as a youth player and you start looking at what you're going to do for high school basketball, and you grew up in Cleveland Heights, was there ever any consideration on your part to go to a private school, or did you always know kind of growing up that you were going to be part of the Cleveland Heights program?
Coming through middle school, I was still really small, and I had a head coach at Roxborough who really didn't believe in me, I could say. So at some point I had thought about changing, getting out of the Cleveland Heights program and going to Chanel, but I ended up sticking it out and going to Heights my freshman year.
Coach Capoletti was still there, correct?
Yeah, he was still there.
Okay, so talk a little bit about what it was like when you eventually got an opportunity to play for Coach Capoletti there at Cleveland Heights, because obviously he has had a tremendous amount of success as a high school coach, and talk about what your experience was like there with him.
Yeah, he was one of the greatest high school coaches. We had a relationship with my brother, my oldest brother. He played basketball for Heights, and Coach Capoletti was his coach. So I was always around, and he already knew me coming up through the process, through sixth grade, seventh grade. So it made the transition easier for me. And but it was a process. I had to take all the steps from ninth grade, play freshman, to 10th grade, sophomore, and so on and so on. I wasn't one of the guys that was hyped up and had all the accolades and things like that. So it was a lot of hard work.
I was going to say, I think that kind of shows, you know, like you said, you weren't the one that was being hyped up, but, and you started with the freshman ranks. Cause you know, you hear a lot of these players that play NBA basketball, play, you know, at D1 schools and play overseas. Like, they're hyped up and they're ready to go. That shows that you had a lot of hard work and you had put a lot of hard work in to get to that point. So I think that's a kind of a testament to what you did throughout your career. What was the hardest part about being, like, you know, I know you said the guy who didn't believe in you in middle school, what was the hardest part for you having a coach that didn't believe in you, and like, how did you use that as motivation?
Just hearing that I wasn't going to play after middle school, that I wasn't going to be able to play in high school just because I pretty much just wasn't good enough. I mean, I was 5'6", maybe 90 pounds coming out of eighth grade, going into high school. So it was rough just hearing that and seeing people that didn't believe in me. But that's what really pushed me to work harder and to just prove the naysayers wrong and prove the guys wrong that it doesn't matter what you think, it's about the work that I'm going to put in to make it to the next level and keep rising.
So describe what that work was like. So what did you do? What was your process for, you know, you leave eighth grade, now you're going to head to the high school. What was your process that you used to try to improve and get better? Were you spending a lot of time in the gym? Were you spending a lot of time at a playground? Were you working with your dad? Were you playing in a lot of games? What exactly did you do to help facilitate your improvement over the course of the next, you know, year or two when you were a freshman and sophomore?
Spent a lot of time in the gym and at the playground. It was a mixture of both. When I could, when my father or brother, they were working, I couldn't get anything done with those guys, I'd go work on my own at Kane Park or at Cumberland Park. And it was a lot of nights of working while other guys were playing and doing other things that were fun. But I was just strictly focused on working on my game and becoming better.
So you went to the park. So you were big in playing outside and playing like on outdoor courts as opposed to playing in. Did you play AAU? Did you not play AAU? I know that's not as big as it was or as it is now when you were playing, but like, did you do AAU or were you primarily, I want to work out at the park and play, you know, pick up games there?
I did AAU later on in like ninth, after my ninth grade year, 10th and 11th grade. Mostly it was just playing pickup ball in the park. And back then that was big. Like the parks were always full to play pickup. So I'd have to get there early or stay late when it emptied to work on my individual game. But to play the pickup games was mostly at the park.
So what do you think is the biggest advantage? This is one of the things that I think, JR, is so different about the way that kids today are playing the game of basketball versus the way that you grew up on the game and the way that I grew up on the game, in that when you're at the playground, you're playing with all different ages, you're playing with all different styles of player, you're playing with some guys that are 35 and, you know, some guys that are 18. And mm-hmm. And so when you do that, you're playing without an official. So you're kind of having to learn sort of the tricks of the trade and how to use your body and how to get your shot off against, you know, a bigger guy, a faster guy, a slower guy, an older guy, a stronger guy. And by doing all those things, I really feel like that was a huge part of what helped me to develop into the player that I became. And so describe how you feel like that process helped you and how you think it might be different for the kids that are coming up today.
Yeah, I agree with you totally. Like when you go into the park, you're playing so many different styles and different types of players that you have to adjust on the fly. You have to learn on the fly. So if you're playing against a 35-year-old or a 20-year-old or college kid, they're not going to take it easy on you. So you have to hold your own. It makes you tougher and it makes you a lot better, because, like you said, one day you might play against a guy whose defense is incredible, and one day your defense is going to have to be incredible because the guy is an unstoppable scorer. So I think that helps a lot. And now this day, you can ride past the park and you don't see, it's like a ghost town. No, but not one kid out there. And I think it's hurting the game. AAU was taking over a lot. It wasn't as big with me as it is now. And a lot of the guys, I would say soft. They don't get pushed. They can't get screamed at. And those things help you become a player. And I think that's, we're losing that part of the game.
Yeah, I think there's a balance, I think, somewhere between the two systems. I definitely think the courts that I grew up playing on right now are the Strongsville Public Library. the courts don't even exist anymore. Where I spent, you know, tons and tons of time when I was a kid. And, you know, and then once I got older and I could drive, or my friends could drive, I just drove around the city to different parks and places, mm-hmm. and, you know, looking for different games to play in.
The lasting memory I have of the Strongsville basketball courts outside was standing waiting for President Bush at the time to land, because that's where he flew in on a helicopter. I was standing on the courts. It was one of the, had to be one of the last years that those courts were there.
Yeah, probably, because I think the library was built in like 95 maybe or something, like somewhere in there. So yeah, but anyway, my hometown courts are gone. So I do think there's a balance between, you know, the playground culture that, you know, that we grew up on, and then, you know, the AAU culture that is prevalent today, in that I think kids today are exposed to, in a lot of cases, better coaching at younger ages, mm-hmm. simply because they have access to, whether it's an AAU coach, whether it's a skills trainer, whether it's a camp or whatever the case may be. So I think there's some positives there, but I also think then there's the negative side of, like you said, one of the things that made you the type of player that you were was just the toughness that you developed and this skill set that you developed by playing against those different kinds of players. So I think if we could find a balance, that would really be the best way to do it. But I, to be honest, I don't know how you feel, but I don't think we're going back ever to kids just going up to the park and playing.
No, I don't think we're going back either. It's just, especially riding by in the summertime, it's just, it was, I remember nights that I would be up there with one of my friends, we'd be playing one-on-one, we'd have the headlights on in the middle of the night, still going at it. I don't think it's going back, but like you said, the guys are, they're getting a lot of different training and have access to a lot of coaches and a lot of indoor gyms now, so that is good for basketball. But sometimes you got to have the different elements to play a real game instead of just training, because nothing converts to the game like playing a game.
Absolutely. So when you left ninth grade, or when you left eighth grade and you head up to the high school, and you said you had a previous relationship with Coach Capoletti through your brother, did he ever have a conversation with you in terms of, hey, you know, I think you're going to have a future in the program? Or were you kind of just completely off his radar when you were a freshman, where he really didn't think much of, you know, your prospects as a player when he was younger? Or did he say, hey, even though maybe you're small right now, I see something in you, keep working? Or was that relationship not really at that point, you know, when you were coming into high school for the first time?
Coming into high school, we didn't really have it. Well, we talked as much. We just knew each other as like friends, not like a working relationship. So I was pretty much with the freshman team, Lloyd Franklin. We didn't have too many combos together until my sophomore year. That's when we really started talking, and he really started seeing things in me, and other people started seeing things in me as well.
So when did you make the varsity as a sophomore or junior? When did you get to get a varsity uniform?
I was able to get one as a sophomore. I went from freshman to sitting on varsity. I never actually touched the court, but I got to run out with the guys and enjoy the layup lines. And if it was a blowout, I'd get in. But I played varsity my sophomore year, but that was I just pretty much dressed like what they would say. I played JV and dressed varsity.
Understood. Yeah, I know that's funny that you say the layup lines, because I tell people all the time that one of the things that I remember vividly about being a kid is going to Strongsville games when I was with my, you know, with my dad when I was maybe in elementary school, I don't know, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, something like that, and just remembering the team coming out with the fight song playing and them coming out with the layup lines. And the thing that I thought was the coolest was they would come out, they'd do their layups, and they'd slap the backboard. And I could never jump anyway, so it was gonna be a long time before I was gonna be able to touch that backboard. But I just remember thinking that was the coolest thing ever, was to be able to run out in that layup line and, you know, and take your layup and slap the backboard. So I can definitely relate to, you know, your excitement to being part of the layup line.
Right. I can relate to the backboard stuff, because as a freshman, like I said, I was only about 5'7", 5'8", so I tried my hardest to touch the backboard without a basketball my freshman year, and I never could. So I had a great growth spurt from my freshman to my sophomore year, and I went from not being able to touch the backboard to, like you said, slapping the backboard on layup. So I really felt good about myself then.
So I know one of the things that, you know, we've talked about before is the fact that you were kind of off the radar in terms of being a big name guy in the Cleveland area and in the recruiting circles and that kind of thing. So how do you feel like that drove you to continue to work on your game and improve and get better? Do you think if you had maybe been a bigger name initially out of the gate, that you might not have worked as hard?
I think that definitely played a part, because when your name is not in the topic of some of the best guys in the city or the best guys in the state, it's just that's added motivation to push you. And I think sometimes people get the big name players get caught up in the hype, and they hear their name so much that it takes them away. They get comfortable, takes them away from the workout that they had coming up. And I think it helped me. So I'm actually happy that I wasn't one of the chosen ones.
And so if you think back to that time and you started to, I'm sure that, because I know I did this, I'm sure you measured yourself against those other names. Like I tell people, I can still remember, I can vividly picture in my head the Plain Dealer, I don't even know what it was called, the Plain Dealer All-Stars, the five guys who were, you know, first team All-City when I was a senior. And mm-hmm. I could tell you where every one of them went to college. I don't know if I have all their college stats memorized, but, you know, I'm pretty sure that I could stack up my college career with any of them. And I know that sort of drove me. And those were guys that I played against in the summertime and, you know, matched up against and felt like I was just as good as. And so I know that was something that drove me. So do you remember the guys that, you know, had those big names that you, whether it was from afar or whether it was actually out on the court, that you measured yourself against?
I probably measured myself against the guys that actually went to Cleveland Heights, because we had such a storied high school that so many years went down the States and so many big name players that came through there. And I measured myself up to those guys. You know, everybody plays against each other in the summer, and I really didn't focus on the other high school guys until it was time to play them in the game. But they were always in the back of my mind. So knowing coming into game day that this was one of the guys that was talked about and was so much better than me and was going so many different places, I definitely circled those calendar dates and wanted to go out there and have a great game.
So who did you look up to as you were coming up through the system in Cleveland Heights? Who were some of the guys that graduated ahead of you that you looked up to and said, man, someday if I could, you know, if I could play like him or be on the Tigers varsity like he is, who are some of those guys that you looked up to?
Two point guards stick out. Jeremy Holmes. He was two years ahead of me, and he was, no, 3 years, I believe. And he was just an incredible point guard, an incredible leader. So I looked up to him, and he took me under his wing. We had like little fun contests and things like that. And Damon Stringer, he was another one who's Mr. Basketball. You know, that's the highest achievement you can have in high school. And he went on to go to Ohio State, and our family knew each other. So those were the two guys that I really looked up to.
And at what point in your high school career did you start to realize that you were going to have an opportunity to play at the next level? When did you start to, you know, get some recruiting letters? When did you start to think that, hey, my dream of continuing my career beyond high school could potentially become a reality?
I think after during my sophomore year, I started believing in myself and I hit the growth spurt, and I started becoming, as people say, the man, and people looked up to me. The teammates look up to me, and they look for me to take over games and things like that. So at that point, I started seeing like I have a chance to do something special with this. And then my sophomore year, I was able to start varsity as the point guard, and we went down the States, and I hit some big free throws that we won States. I was a key part of the team, and from that point on, I knew that I had a chance. I still wasn't highly recruited my sophomore year, and then my junior year, I started getting some mid-majors, but no really big teams, ACC and Big East or things like that. And the letters were coming in, and after we won that state championship, St. Bonaventure from the Atlantic 10, they offered me a scholarship early. I went there for a visit. I liked the visit, and they offered a scholarship, and I accepted it. And after that, I had an incredible senior year. I averaged 25, 26 points a game, and that's when a lot of the bigger schools came talking and came recruiting. But I'm a loyal person, and I didn't even consider going to any of those teams. So I ended up at St. Bonaventure.
Do you think it might have been different had those schools gotten in earlier, or was it the coaching staff at St. Bonaventure and just the feel you had from the guys when you went on your recruiting visit? Do you think you still would have considered St. Bonaventure had you been getting, you know, more looks from Big Ten schools or ACC schools?
I think if they had came early, then I probably wouldn't have went to St. Bonaventure. If the Kentuckys, the USCs, and I got a couple letters from those teams, they had came at the same time that St. Bonaventure came, then I probably would have went bigger. But I stuck with Bonaventure because they saw the potential in me early. The other teams, they saw it after the product was already done. So
right. So what, when you got there and you show up on campus at St. Bonaventure for the first time, mm-hmm. and you you know, you go out for your first workout or you work out with the team, what were your biggest adjustments from high school to going in and suiting up at the Division I level for the first time?
It's a completely different monster. I wasn't expecting how different it would be. I thought the transition would be smooth, but from your strength coach to getting up at 6 a.m. and lifting weights and then having to go to classes and then having to go to practice, that was it was a lot harder than what I expected. And from high school to college, you pretty much playing against grown men, 20, 21, your seniors and those guys, and I'm coming in as a frail freshman. So I had a lot of work ahead of me as far as weightlifting and being able to play at that level, that high on that college level.
Do you think that it was the adjustments, I don't want to say off the court, but you talk about like working on your athleticism, whether that's, you know, strength, speed, quickness, that kind of thing, and mm-hmm. just maturing, and the off-court stuff just in terms of the schedule and having to manage your time and all that, do you think those pieces of it were a bigger adjustment, or do you think that the actual competing on the basketball court was a bigger adjustment?
I think the managing your time, it played a part because you're so used to a set schedule. In high school, you have someone waking you up and you do the classes and you can go to practice once and you don't have to focus on all those other things. In college, you're all alone, you're by yourself, so everything is on you. But I thought pretty much the basketball part was the hardest part. When I came in, I was matched up. Well, not matched up, but the starting point guard, this was a guy named Tim Nguyen, and he was from upstate New York. He's a little 5'10", but he was a bull, and it was probably one of the best defenders I've ever played against in my life. So it was I was thrown right into the fire, like, you have to produce or you're going to get embarrassed. So.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I think anytime, you know, I know, just speaking for myself, one of the biggest adjustment for me was there was just so much about the game of basketball that that I learned my freshman year of college that I had no idea even went on. Like, when I went to college, that was the first time I had ever heard the term closeout. Mm-hmm. I had never heard that in all my years, you know, so 18 years of basketball, I had never heard that term. And, right. you know, now you look back at it, you're like, man, there was a lot, you know, I had so much to learn. And then I think for me, it was the speed, you know, the speed of the game. You play in high school and, you know, most of the time you're out on the floor, you're the best player. And, mm-hmm. you know, you get to college and, you know, everybody has skills and everybody has ability. And so for me, you know, I'll use a term that we've used on the podcast before. Sometimes people would try to describe me as sneaky athletic, and I always say I don't think I was any athletic. So I had to figure out a way to be successful and do something that was going to set me apart. And I kind of just decided that I was going to, you know, work harder than anybody else to make myself the best player that I could possibly be. And it was still, you know, again, it's an adjustment. You go from high school being the best player on the floor to suddenly you're playing against guys every day that are, you know, 6'7", 6'8", that can jump and have long arms and just, you know, again, have a different skill set than what you're used to playing against. So I know that was a big, big adjustment for me when I got to, you know, when I got to college. And then also the other thing is, you know, in high school, not that I didn't play any defense, but I certainly was mm-hmm. certainly was not a defensive player in high school. And, you know, I looked around the landscape when I was in college and just, you know, figured out, hey, we got lots of guys who can score, but if I can play defense, it'll get me on the floor. And, you know, it got me a little bit of time as a freshman. And then by the time I was a sophomore, I think I was the fifth leading scorer in our starting lineup. But, you know, I started every game. So, you know, right. you make adjustments and you kind of figure out what, you know, what works. So for you, as you're going through and you're playing at St. Bonaventure, what are some of your best memories of your time playing college basketball?
Every year I have a different memory. It's amazing how it worked out for me coming in. I was thrown right into the fire. The point guard Tim Nguyen, he had got injured, and I was the backup point guard. So I ended up starting my freshman year, and that was amazing, just playing against the big team like UMass, the team that I used to watch on TV.
Right.
That I didn't even realize were in the Atlantic 10. Like, oh my God, look at these guys. Look how big this guy is. Look how fast right. this guy is.
And yep.
I was thrown right into the fire and to have to play against those guys and match up those against those guys. So I went from being starstruck to being the guy that's going at them. So that was one of my starting moments when I was able to play as a freshman, which is rare to come in and be able to have some actual significant minutes, and that helped start my college career. And sophomore year, I broke my foot second practice of the season, and I remember just sitting out debating if I was going to sit out the whole year. The team they were really behind me, and they wanted me to come back, so I came back probably January of that year. We actually made the NCAA tournament. Played down at Cleveland State, and I was lost in double overtime to Kentucky, but I was the player of the game, and it was just a fun time.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a lot of fun. At what point during your St. Bonaventure career, kind of like your same question that I asked you about your high school career, when you mm-hmm. know, when you realized you were getting to college, at what point did you kind of think, hey, I might have a chance to play beyond college?
After those guys that were ahead of me graduated, and I ended up being a starting point guard my junior year, we went to the NIT tournament, and I actually made an All Atlantic 10 team. And when I heard my name get called for that, it struck me again, like, okay, I have a chance to do something. I'm one of the best 15 players in the whole conference. Like, I mean, that doesn't come easy. And unfortunately, we lost our coach. He decided to go to Rhode Island. We had a new coach, Jan Van Bredekoff, who came from a fast-paced West Coast style college. And we went over to Europe, and he moved me to the two guard and wanted me to score. And I didn't realize I still had those abilities. In high school, I was a scorer, and then when you got to college, you couldn't do the same things you did in high school. I had to be a point guard. So he turned me back into a scorer, and I averaged like 40 over against those pros over there, and that was before the season. And once that happened, it was just the sky was the limit for me, I believe.
So what? This is an aside. I'm gonna get back to your pro potential in a second. But which position did you like playing better? Did you like playing the two, or did you like playing the point better?
That's a tough. I knew that if I wanted to play at the next level, I would have to be a point. But it's always fun to be able to put that ball in the hole anytime you wanted to, and shoot anytime you from anywhere you wanted to. So I loved playing the two, just as from scoring wise. But I knew that if I wanted to play after college, I had to be a point guard. So it was a mixture of both. But I think everybody loves to score.
Yeah, for sure. It's funny because I go back and forth on that. And when I was in college, I played mostly the two, but I played probably three quarters of my senior year as the point, because our point guard was hurt. And then in the summertime, I played the point all the time. Like, I love playing point guard when I had the opportunity to play with other great players, and just to be able to share the ball and get the ball moving down the floor. And I just always liked having the ball in my hands,
right?
Which is what I really liked about playing the point versus playing the two. So I'm always curious when I hear guys that kind of swing back and forth between positions, which one they like better. And again, everybody loves to score, and I'm certainly no different. But I spent most of my time, you know, playing summer basketball. I tried to keep the ball in my hands as much as I possibly could. So, thanks for sharing that. So you realize that, hey, I've got some pro potential now. You get done, you graduate, and now you're looking around at your options, and you have some opportunities to get to the NBA. Describe what that process was like after you graduated from St. Bonaventure, and now you're embarking on the road towards a pro career. Describe what that looked like.
That process actually started during my senior season. Started getting recruitment started happening again from different agents who wanted to represent you and told you things that they can do for you, and you had to figure out who's the most genuine, who really believed in you and was trying to help you out instead of just trying to find a payday for themselves. So the recruiting process to even get started was something in itself. And then after that, it was a lot of work, a lot of basketball, a lot of once classes were over, getting into the gym. And my brother, he took off 3 months and came up there and lived with me. And every chance we could, we get in there and we work on our game. And I took some time off from college. I took a break, came back home to work with the speed strength here in Cleveland. Tim Robertson, Eric Lichter, they to prepare for the different camps that happened after and during your college year.
Was that while they were still at the Euclid Sports Plant?
Yep, Euclid Sports Plant. That was the beginning of them starting.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then he ended up at Ohio State. With the strength and conditioning with the football team, it's kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes where people get their start and where they end up. So what were some of the things that they had you doing to get prepared to work on your athleticism? What were some of the things that they had you do?
We did a lot of work with bands on the court. Like, I was always had a band connected to me, whether it be defensive slides where the band pulls you back fast, but you gotta push to get out there, or even doing layups and shooting. A band was always connected to me, always pulling me. So once you took that band off, your explosiveness felt crazy. It was amazing how it felt when you go in for a layup and the band to pull you back, and then you go in, you take the band off, and you go in, you feel like you can jump from the free throw line and
right,
take the ball. So
yeah.
It was they really got me prepared for the testing and everything that they had at Chicago camp, where everybody goes out of college and do the NBA testing with different drills and weightlifting and things like that. And we prepared for that really well. I ended up being the number one tested guy out of college, out of everyone.
That's fantastic. And so describe what that process was like in Chicago. Obviously they're testing your athleticism, but they also, play some games. So talk a little bit about what that was. Did you play in the games? Because I know now a lot of guys don't play.
Yeah, I did. There was one Phoenix Phoenix testing before Chicago. I got invited to. And that's what majority of the college players get invited to. Chicago is really hard to get into because it's like the top guys.
Right.
And I declined Phoenix because I knew that only my agent he suggested that we don't go, because only 3 or 4 guys out of those 300 get invited to Chicago. So we declined it. They said it was a bad idea. We just took our chances of getting that invite to Chicago and putting in the work. And then once you got there, it was a few guys, the top 12, top 13 guys, those guys didn't play, but they all did the testing with the weight bench. You had to do 185 and the sprint and the vertical leap and the sprint slide. Everybody did that. And then I ended up playing in all the games, but you only play a half.
So who are the big guy? Who are the big names that? Who are the big names that played the year that you were there in Chicago?
None of the big names really played. Anthony Grundy, he played. Steve Logan played maybe one quarter, and he decided not to play anymore. So all the guys that most people know by name, they sat the games out, but they did the conditioning and the testing.
Gotcha. And so coming out of that, what was the feedback that you got from NBA guys after you came out of the combine?
Oh, great feedback. But it was back to the thing that I needed to be a point guard. They kept harping on that, because I think I averaged 14 points, but that was only for a half. But my defense, that's what they really raved about. I was picking up full court. Like you said, you always have to find your niche to stick out, because everybody at that level, everybody's good. Everybody can shoot. Everybody can play. But you got to find something that makes you stick out. And I think defense did it for me. Every game, full court, as soon as you turn around, 94 feet, I was there. So the feedback was great. And then we started doing individual workouts. And that's when the team invites you in, and 3 or 4 guys, and you guys are working out against each other and showing off your skill set and playing one-on-one at the same time.
Which of those individual workouts do you have any vivid memories of any particular team or workout that you went to in the process? Something that stood out, maybe something that was unusual, or somebody that you played against, or an unusual request that a team had of you while you were there?
Some of the crazy. You'd be at the hash mark behind 3-point line, and they want you to take one dribble and get to the basket. And that was something new for me, which is possible that now I know that it is, but I would never think about that. But that's how these guys cover so much ground, just taking less dribbles and taking bigger steps. But I think in Houston, I really wasn't athletic. I dunked maybe twice my whole career in college, and in Houston they made us stay at the elbow and go back door and catch the alley-oop. And I said, oh man, everybody's gonna catch this alley-oop. No way in the world I'm gonna catch this alley-oop. And yeah, I turned, he threw it, and he had to put it in the perfect spot, and I caught the alley-oop and dunked it. That's one of my best memories.
All-time highlights. They got that on film?
And I wish.
Good thing they didn't put that test on me. They would have had to lower the basket to about 8.5 feet. 8
that's
and a half
what
feet
I thought, too, but I thought how I dunked it. That adrenaline had you up there.
That's awesome. So as you go through that whole process, describe how it ends up for you and how you end up being on a team and what that experience was like.
Oh, I did maybe 20 individual workouts, which is really rare. So I'm at this point before the draft, I'm super excited. A lot of teams saying that they were gonna come get me. I went to Toronto for a second workout right before the draft. So I really thought that they were gonna draft me. I had a draft party and everything. Didn't get drafted. It was amazing. I don't know what happened, but maybe midway through the second round, all the teams were calling saying they wanted me to come for a summer league and this and that. And I don't know. I'm a kid. I don't understand. I'm saying the draft is still 20 more picks. What you mean? What you want me to come to summer league? Like, hold on, I might still hear my name. And
right.
I guess they knew something that I didn't know. So it was frustrating, but it made me work harder and go to these different summer leagues. And I played at three teams and ended up at Boston, the team I didn't even work out for. I was stopping by there for a mini camp for 2 days and playing the summer league before I went back to Toronto, where I thought I was going to end up, and had a great 2 days and ended up signing with, they offered me a contract, but they told me don't even go to Toronto. They offered me a 2-year deal.
And so you're there in Boston. How exciting was it to put your signature on that first contract?
Oh, it was amazing. When I got it, I called home so excited because they didn't even know I was in Boston. I was supposed to be in LA, but I left LA because I wasn't playing. So we just took a red eye to Boston, and I called them and said they offered me a contract. And they was like, "Who? Memphis?" And I was like, "No, not Memphis. I'm in Boston right now." You didn't even work out for Boston. I said, "I know. I had no history or anything, but they offered and I took it. It was incredible."
And so you go to training camp with the Celtics for that first year. And what's that experience like to suddenly be on the floor with guys that, you know, you've watched and obviously you've seen, you know, the uniform, not only the Celtics, but the other teams you're playing against? Describe what that feeling was like stepping out onto an NBA floor for the first time.
Oh, man, the nerves that you have going on and the butterflies that's in your stomach can't even explain it, because you go through the practice with your teammates, you meet everybody, the all-stars, Paul Pierce and Antoine Walker, and then those guys take you in, they take you under their wing. Practices are fun, but you're the rookie, so they're making you do all type of things that you normally would do, have towels sitting in that locker, bringing donuts, going to the store at all types of hours. So it was it was fun. And in the first game, you know, you see the arena and there's 20,000 people for a preseason game. They embarrass you from the start. You're the first guy to go out, so you say your hype, you get in your huddle, you do everything, you run out, but the only thing is your team behind you, they don't run out, so you're in the middle of the floor by yourself looking
welcome
great
to the NBA, the JR
team, right, while the team is just laughing at you. They welcome to the NBA, then they come running out.
So how crazy was it, the fact that, I mean, you didn't get drafted. You didn't. There were teams that weren't playing you and whatnot. How crazy was it that I did some research. So you started 41 games as a rookie. How crazy was it to you that you're the guy that didn't even like seemingly weren't on anyone's radar, and then you go and start 41 games as a rookie in the NBA?
It was surreal. Like I always believed in myself, but you know, to have that opportunity. And they would always tell me, the guys in the locker room, like, your opportunity is going to come. You just have to be ready for it. Like, you're going to get a chance, but when you get that chance, it might not be a big one. You have to take advantage of it. And every day in practice, I wasn't playing in the beginning of the year. I wasn't getting in, but I was always the first one in the gym for practice that next day, and with the coaches, and they kept pushing me, and it got a little frustrating. We just sitting on the bench because you're not used to that. And 48 minutes, you don't play 1 second. Do that, you get a DNP. And finally, unfortunately for the person, but it was fortunate for me, the point guard Tony Delke hurt his ankle, and Shamion Williams wasn't playing to the expectation as the coaches, and they called me into the office, and I actually thought that I was going to get cut. I thought I was going to get waived. So I was walking to the office nervous, and they told me, tomorrow you're going to start against Steve Francis. I said, what a way to start my career. Welcome to the NBA.
Yeah, that's right. So as you go through and you know, obviously you get more comfortable, I'm sure, as that process goes on. What's your best memory from that first season with the Celtics, besides running out on the court without your teammates and, you know, obviously getting your first NBA action? Is there something that stands out from that first year that, you know, you'll never forget?
Yeah, for me, I was always known for my hard work and my playing hard all the time. And I think what stood out, we were on a West Coast trip, Texas trip now. And we played Dallas and Houston and San Antonio, and we were playing against Dallas. This is during the time I wasn't playing. We played Houston the very next day, 2 days later, sorry. And we were down 30, and coach called me, JR, go in. We had 30 with like a minute left, minute 15 left. So take your things off, you get on the court. And it was a loose ball going back court, and I sprinted as hard as I could and dove for the loose ball, got the ball for the team, and we made a layup. And, you know, for anybody else, they just, okay, you're down 30. But the coaches and myself, that's what really pushed me over the top. Like, this kid is diving for balls, and we're down 30 points. Like, we have no chance of winning. We have no chance of anything. And he's playing his heart out, like the game is tied. And that really stood out for me, and it solidified how hard I play and how dedicated I was to the game.
All right, so I have to ask this. We are from Cleveland, and you got to play for your hometown team for you know, 31 games, and not to mention the fact that you were also on the team when a certain guy entered the NBA. What was it like playing with LeBron as a rookie and like being around him? I know the hype machine was crazy probably even as a rookie, but like, what was it like for you being around, A, for being in Cleveland playing for the team that you probably grew up loving, and then B, being around the other guy from the area and just kind of the whole, I guess, entourage that probably occurred with that?
Yeah, when I found out that I was going to get traded, we played against LeBron and the Cavs in the summer league. It would be my second year, and he had a great game. I had a great game. And a couple of weeks later, I got the call that I was going to get traded to Cleveland. I thought that was just the best thing that could ever happen. Like, it's what you dream of, to play where you're growing up. And then the hype that LeBron had, like you said, it was a media frenzy and practices and all the games. It was just so many cameras and reporters and everything like that. But it was fun. You know, he was a young kid, but his talent was, you can see the potential that he had, the IQ that he had was incredible.
Do you think that, you know, if you look back at that time, was it the IQ that stood out the most? What was it about LeBron that when you were with him there every day, what was it about him that from a player standpoint that you knew that he just was going to be a special, you know, a special talent?
I would say the IQ. Everybody knew the world knew how athletic he was and how skilled of a player as he was. But when you got to talk to him and see him in practice every day and see his basketball IQ for an 18-year-old was unheard of for me. The things that he saw, the things that he knew, the way that he worked on his game, that he learned the game, and his personality. He never let any of the hype get to his head, and you can tell that he just enjoyed basketball. He was a funny guy. he had fun with his teammates, so that at that point I knew he was going to be special.
Do you think that, I think one of the things that always has kind of impressed me about him, again, from afar, and obviously not from an insider's perspective, but it seemed like just from the time he was, you know, from the time he was 18, that he just had this, you know, this natural calm and this natural ability to kind of be in the public and handle things the right way. Did mm-hmm. you get that? Did you get that sense, you know, as his teammate, that that was something that, again, it's not normal for an 18-year-old kid to be able to handle the things that were put in front of him.
Right.
You know, did was that something that you could see from the inside?
Yeah. You saw it from the beginning. Like I said, you couldn't. He didn't let those things go to his head, and it was tough because every day it was somebody on him. Every day the media was at him. And they were crowning him the king and the chosen one that he has on his back. And it's at 18, it's hard to go through all that and not let it go to your head and distract you from your actual game. But it never distracted him. And he always kept the course. And he's still doing it.
He still is.
It's even hard. It's harder now because the entourage has gotten that much bigger, and he still handles it really well.
Not to mention that he's in LA, and I know we're recording this on the 24th. So last night they had the whole huge overtime game against San Antonio, and mm-hmm. he hits that huge 3-pointer to put the game to overtime. And of course, I wanted to stay up and watch the game, so I sat up here and watched it. And then he makes that three, and I'm like, "Oh man, now I gotta watch overtime." and it looked like he had distorted the game, and then he missed the free throws at the end. And I was like, right. "Oh my gosh, LeBron!" Like,
right?
And it's so, you know, so you could just see the pressure bouncing on him even at this point. But he seemed so calm when he shot that three at the end of regulation last night. That was amazing.
Yeah, that wasn't even a normal three. That was a couple feet behind the regular.
Oh yeah, he was at Steph Curry range.
Shooting practice, right. Shot it easy, and it was nothing but net.
So your season ends in Cleveland, and that's the end of your 2-year contract, and then you end up in Golden State. So how did that process go of getting your second contract, and talk a little bit about your time with Golden State?
I actually got waived in Cleveland midway, a little bit past the midway point in Cleveland. A lot of teams, it's another thing that I would never understand. A lot of teams were asking to trade for me, and Cleveland was saying, "No, we're going to keep them. And March 1st is the deadline to get waived. You get waived before March 1st, you can go to any playoff team that you want to go to. If you get waived after March 1st, then you're only allowed to go to a team that's not playoff eligible. So March 2nd comes. I get the phone call to come down to the office. I said, okay, and I got waived on March 2nd, which I still to this day don't understand why I got waived, or even why I got waived on March 2nd and not the day before, where I could have went to a playoff team. So it was still under the same contract. So that contract was still going on with the Cleveland Cavaliers. And Golden State, they offered me a 10-day contract to come out there and play because Speedy Claxton was hurt. And I went out and lived in Oakland in the hotel for two 10-day contracts, and we played my last game, and they told me they weren't going to sign me for the rest of the season, and I ended up coming home to Cleveland. That after that game, I flew home to Cleveland, and two days later, Golden State Warriors were coming to Cleveland to play him. Avery Johnson ended up getting hurt in the away game, and then I ended up signing for the rest of the season with the Warriors and met him right downtown at the Q, or Gund Arena, when that's what it was when that time.
So I have a question. What do you think? I know you probably have thought about this a lot in your life after the NBA and going playing Europe. But what do you think happened from the first year when you played? You know, you started 41 games, and then all of a sudden you were having to do 10 days. Is that just part of the gig with the NBA? Like, things, life comes at you fast, you know that phrase, like,
right.
What do you think changed? Was there something that changed in you, or was it just the way that they kind of rolled out and kind of got dealt unlucky hand?
I think that's just the way it rolled out. It's so unpredictable with the NBA, and you got to be in the situations is very key. In Boston, I had the ideal situation with Jim O'Brien, who loved a point guard that could shoot. So he didn't really bring the ball up. Antoine and Paul brought the ball up. He just surrounded those guys with shooters. So that was ideal for me to spot up and shoot the threes and knock the threes down. I think that's what helped me make the second team all rookie. So I'm going into the next year thinking that we're going to have an incredible season. We have made it to the second round of the playoffs and got traded to Cleveland. In another situation at that time, DeJuan Wagner was hurt. So the first couple games, I had got a lot of playing time with Cleveland. The opening night versus Sacramento, I played 30 minutes, something like that. And once DeJuan Wagner came back, it was just my role diminished to the bench. And a lot of it has to do with, I would say, money as well. I was on a minimum contract, and they were on big contracts. So those guys had to play. And it went from playing a lot of minutes to the bench role to getting waived to 10-day contract.
So the NBA doesn't work out the way that you hoped it would, and obviously you were hoping for a long NBA career, but you still have an opportunity then to go and continue your professional career overseas. So once it became, I don't know if clear is the right word, but once you didn't get another NBA opportunity the following season, describe the process of how you went about getting overseas and getting an opportunity to play.
Well, you have your agent, and he handles all of that for you. So it's just pretty much you sit by the phone and you get the phone calls. And a team from Spain had called, and they were playing in the EuroLeague, which is the next top league behind the NBA. And they offered a contract, and it was really nice. And I still had opportunities to play in the summer league with some NBA teams, and then maybe had chances to go to training camp. But I knew there probably was going to make more money, and I was going to be able to play. And just going from that, my last season where I just was on the bench and did the 10-day contracts and met teams and living out my bag, I made the decision that I just wanted to play. It wasn't really about being in the NBA. It was being able to play the game that I love. So that's when I decided to go over to Europe.
What was that like the first time you go over to Europe and you're there and, you know, you're in a new culture, in a new country? I'm assuming you don't speak the language, and, you know, you've got obviously an adjustment as a young guy over there for the first time. Describe what that was like, your first experience being overseas. Because obviously I'm sure you got used to the process as it went along. And, you know, once you were over there for 5 or 6 years, the adjustment I'm sure wasn't as big. But talk about that first time the plane touched down and now you're in a foreign country and you don't speak the language and you're trying to figure it all out.
Yeah, that first year beginning was really rough, because like when you land, everything was in Spanish, like all the the signs to follow, everything was in Spanish. There was somebody waiting for you that had your name on a board, but he didn't speak any English as well, so it was an adjustment. Luckily, a lot of my teammates, they spoke English, a lot of the Spanish guys, and we had a lot of different cultures from France and Argentina, so those guys helped the process a lot. And the coach, he spoke English, so it was that part made it a little bit easier. But trying to live and going to the restaurants and getting gas and things like that, where the gas is by the liter, not by the gallon. So
how much gas am I buying?
And it's way more expensive over there. You know, people complain about gas prices here. You know, my aunt and uncle live in England, and every time I go over, I've gone over there, I don't know, countless times, and I'm looking at them paying how much money they pay per liter, and I'm like, oh man, people in America, we complain about gas prices, but you don't even know.
We don't know how good we have it. It was like 3 euros a liter. I'm like, I don't know. I'm thinking it's just gallons. They just call it a liter until I realized my tank didn't have much in it.
When I put it in, why am I running out of gas after 15 minutes?
Right.
Come on, what's the deal?
I just thought I filled this thing up. It's up to 18 liters, but 18 liters is nothing. So that was that was a crazy process. And then I was the only American. So it was a little bit harder for me. But like I said, the guys, the French guys and Argentinian guys, they spoke perfect English. So they helped a lot. Just learning how to order your food and things like that was a long process.
So how many different countries did you play in over the course of your career over there?
How many did I play or how many did I live in?
How many? Well, all right. Give me either one. I'll take either piece of information.
I probably lived in about seven or eight, but I played in probably double digits, 15, 16.
Gotcha. So which country can you narrow it down to one or two favorite countries that you lived in?
Yeah, I got I would say Italy was probably my favorite country because basketball was great. The city, I lived in Milan, so that was great. And the food was great, so it's a mixture of everything. I would put Italy as my number one.
All right, I don't want to throw any country under the bus, but which one was your least favorite?
Who? Or do you...
If you still have friends there, you know, you can just decline. You can decline to answer if you want.
I would say, as far as living, I would say Russia probably was my least favorite because it's just
go figure.
Oh my goodness, living in Russia it's so big and so much snow and it's nasty outside and. A lot of the Russian people really don't care too much for Americans or anything outside the Russian culture. So it was a process. But, I mean, I had to have liked it a little bit because I stayed there for 5 years. So something
was that, was that your it. Was that your longest ten, is that, was
maybe,
that your...
maybe you like the paycheck, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that was, something was good about it. Yeah, that was my longest tenure in Russia, five, six years.
So maybe that's why you don't like. Maybe that's why it's your least favorite because you spent the most time there.
Right.
could be. So what the story that I always love to hear is I know you have, I don't know what it is, but I know you have a crazy European basketball story. What's the craziest thing that you experienced while you were over there playing?
Probably during the game. We were down one and it was maybe 3 seconds left and we hit a shot. To when I was playing in Russia, but I was playing for a Turkish team, and we hit the shot to win the game, and they went to the replay, and the ball was clearly out of the guy's hand with the red line around the backboard, and they still counted it as no good because the buzzer had went off, regardless of the light, it didn't matter, but the buzzer had, because he had the ball in his hand when the buzzer went off. But when you look at the light that shows when it's supposed to go off, they didn't pay that any attention. We ended up losing that game.
Yeah, that's not good.
it sounds like a little bit of collusion. I mean, right. I don't want to accuse the Russians of collusion or anything.
Something's going on over there, and I played there for them 5 years, so I knew the fix was in. But
that sounds like the 72 Olympics or something. Sounds like there was a little bit of chicanery going on over there.
Yeah.
They weren't above that in the Olympics, so I'm sure they certainly weren't above it when J.R. Bremer was on the court.
Exactly.
So now that you're done, how much do you miss the day-to-day being able to go out and compete and play?
I miss it tremendously. You don't like the saying says, you don't realize what you have until it's gone. And it's like it's days here that I don't even know what to do with myself. So I was so used and so accustomed after 15 years to in the last 13 and getting up in the morning, practicing, coming home, going to sleep, eating. Going back to practice, coming home, eating, going to sleep, and now these days seem like they're so long because I don't have that, and just I still have the itch inside me to play and be able to compete, and just because I'm a competitor, and so it's a tough transition, a lot tougher than what I thought it was going
to
be.
Let me extend an invitation for you to play on my summer league Sunday night basketball league in Strongsville. You know. There's no big paychecks involved, but it's a good time.
I might have to come out there just to release some of this basketball.
I want to note, Earl Boykins used to play in our league when he was like 45 and 46, and he was still dropping 40 points on everyone. It was pretty comical because...
Earl is incredible. I still don't know how he does it.
He still plays. I've seen him playing still. I mean, I don't know how old he is now, but... He still plays and he still is efficient. So, but I'm formally inviting you to play with my team.
So Coach Jason's not supposed to use the podcast as a recruiting tool, but he has done it before to critical acclaim. So I kind of have to let him go if I want him to run the tech side of the podcast. I kind of got to let his recruiting pitches go. in all seriousness, the transition from playing to not playing, I'm sure, has got to be tough. I mean, you already kind of described it as tough, but it's something that you've done, you know, from your entire life. For as long as you can remember, there's always been kind of the rhythm of, you know, I'm getting ready for the season, I'm training, then there's the season, and I'm in the off season, I'm getting ready for the next season again. And so to not have that, how difficult has it been, and what are some of the things that you have on the horizon, some of the things that you're looking to do to continue on with your life? Because obviously there's a transition for any professional athlete who's mm-hmm. spent their entire life, you know, focused on one thing, kind of had that, you know, that basketball season rhythm, and now suddenly that's gone. Describe what that looks like.
I'm still catch myself training and I'm about to go back over and play and getting ready for the season. I have to catch myself not to watch as much basketball, because it makes me continue to want to play. Like you said, 15 years professional, but I've been playing all my life. So to reach this point where the basketball is going to stop for me playing has been difficult, and the transition has been difficult, but I'm pushing through it. And the next, I want to get into coaching and running some camps, and just to give back the knowledge that I've had, knowledge that I've learned, the story that I have, which is unique, I think, as far as going from not going to make my high school team to being a second team all rookie and playing 15 years professionally. So give back to the kids, get a knowledge, teach, and get into coaching.
Yeah, I think it's a great story that you have. And we really appreciate you jumping on the podcast with us tonight, JR. And before we get out of here, if people want to reach out to you, is there a way that they can get in touch with you, either email or social media? And then also, if there's anything else that we didn't touch on that you want to share with the audience before we get out of here, go ahead and do that now.
Yeah, my Instagram is jbrem22, J-B-R-E-M. And the number 22, or you can reach me on my email is jbrem, the number 9@yahoo.com. So those are the two platforms that you can reach me at. I'm pretty good at responding back fast. Other than that, we covered everything. Thank you guys for having me on. It was a fun time. Good chance to tell my story, and I loved it.
Absolutely, JR. We appreciate you jumping on and staying up late with us. Like I said, we're doing our late night.
It's quarter to one.
we're wrapping up late at night here, but we really appreciate you coming on. You've been, it's been great getting to know you over the last year or two, and we're definitely hoping that we can do more things together with you, because I really like what you're all about. I love your story, and we can't thank you enough for staying up late and being willing to jump on the podcast with us. So thanks for coming on, and to everyone out there, thank you, and we'll catch you on our next episode.
If you're looking for a great way to spend the holidays playing some basketball, please join us at one of our Head Start Basketball Holiday Camps on December 27th and 28th, 2018. We'll have a camp at Hoop Guru Courthouse in Hinckley, and also at St. Pascal Bailon School in Highland Heights. The Head Start Basketball Holiday Camps will emphasize the fundamentals of basketball, with individual attention given to each camper. You'll improve your basketball skills and have a ton of fun at the Head Start Basketball Holiday Camp. To register or get more information, please visit our website, www.headstartbasketball.com. Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, brought to you by Head Start Basketball.